Whenever we use our pain as an excuse to sin, we have forgotten the main purpose of our lives. Too often when life lets us down, we think to ourselves, I need a little comfort. I need a little spoiling. I need a little bit of joy in my life, so we turn to sin to satisfy us. James reminds us in this opening exhortation of his letter that the goal of our lives is to be holy. Look at verse 4. He puts it this way: perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. James, we know, is writing to a group of believers who are not mature and who are not pursuing holiness in their walk. It is suggested by the commentators that James 4, verse 4 to 10, is probably the central exhortation of this letter. So what is this letter? What lies at the heart of this letter? Go to James 4, 4 to 10. This might give you a little bit of an insight into how James views the spiritual problems of this church. He writes, "You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you suppose it is to no purpose that the scripture says, he yearns jealously over the spirit that he has made to dwell in us, but he gives more grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you." This is a letter written to people who are struggling with worldliness. And so the letter therefore has a certain tone, and it has more imperatives per capita than any other letter in the New Testament. In other words, there's more commands in the book of James, that, you know, given how many verses it has, than any other book in the New Testament. And so even here at the beginning, you get a little bit of this tone. There's no, "and I thank the Lord for you, and when I pray for you, I pray that." All the niceties are moved to the side. And James jumps straight into exhortation. But let us not think that he is insensitive. Let us not think that he's without a pastoral concern. James begins recognizing that he writes to hurting people. People that are going through trials. He recognizes that our lives are full of difficulties. And that's where he begins. You'll notice that almost the whole of chapter 1 is concerned with testing and temptation. There's a big debate in the commentaries about how you should structure the book of James. You know, what's the flow of the argument? And most commentators would agree that, well, basically what you have in chapter 1 is James introduces all the main topics, and then he circles back to them again throughout the book. So you basically have the issues of trial, rich and poor, true religion, matters related to the tongue and anger, and he comes back to all of these later on. Now, what is the situation that the author James is writing to? What is the difficulty that is causing their trials? Is it persecution? Maybe they were persecutors, maybe Jewish employers, which was leading to ostracism and poverty? Or was there a famine, maybe Acts 11 verse 28, where there was a famine that afflicted the whole region? What is the troubles that's causing the trials? And it seems that there's a mix of both religious persecution and just the general difficulties of economic collapse. So this is a letter which is applicable across the board to all sorts of Christians in all sorts of suffering. But as so often happens, when we suffer, our holiness slips. We don't bear up under tough times. The pain can even become the reason why we begin to doubt God, why we stop pursuing holiness. We give up on our praying. So James is writing to encourage true religion in testing times. If I could give a title to the book of James, that would be it. True religion in testing times. So today we begin where James begins, with our trials. And so let's read again verses 2 to 4, the portion we'll be looking at this evening. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. A great way to understand the main thrust of these opening verses is to read them backwards. Read them backwards in terms of the development of thought. So if you begin with James's last thought in these verses, he tells us that the goal of our lives is to be holy. But in order to be holy, we have to let steadfastness have its full effect. But in order to exercise steadfastness, what do we need? Trials. And since we are experiencing the testing of our faith in all kinds of trials, we can therefore have true joy over our trials, because the main goal of holiness is possible and being accomplished within us by our good Father, who is directing our steps and who controls our situation. I'm going to divide these verses up into two points, and I'm following here the two main commandments in these verses. The first commandment is, by thinking right, we can attain joy. And the second commandment is, by steadfastness we can attain maturity. Let steadfastness have its way with you. So verse 2, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. Have any of you ever struggled with this verse? This is one of those verses that you don't pull out when someone's loved one has just died, or someone has just been given a diagnosis of cancer. It seems so callous. Count it all joy. What does this verse mean? That word all can mean inclusively everything. But in this instance, it means meant intensively, not inclusively. In other words, James is saying something more like this. Consider trials an opportunity for true joy, or an opportunity for pure joy, as the NIV translates it. James is not saying that every single part of all that you suffer is to be ticked off as joy. You're allowed to not like your pain, okay? We do not rejoice over the fallen world that we live in. We do not rejoice over the sin that so often causes suffering. We do not rejoice over the devil. We do not rejoice in the pain we or others feel, as if pain were something good in itself. The loss of a loved one is not good. Getting cancer is not good. Losing your job is not good. However, James is saying that no matter how bad it gets, the Christian is still able to count it or consider it true joy because of the good that God brings out of it. So we need to make very clear, we do not want to pretend that sin is somehow in and of itself, or suffering is somehow in and of itself good. That's a common misunderstanding when reading these verses. Trials are good, not in themselves, but for what they produce. Know what that means? You have permission to mourn. You have permission to feel your pain and bring your complaints to the Lord. You have permission to not like what you're going through and seek to improve your own situation, if you can. So you'll notice that James is writing to believers. He calls them brothers, inclusively brothers and sisters, indicating that he is writing to Christians. They are one in the faith. And this is important to note, because there is a joy that believers alone can have because of their relationship with God. Now, this teaching about being able to rejoice as a result of our trials is not the teaching of James alone. We do find it in other portions of Scripture. Paul teaches us the same thing in Romans 5:3. Not only that, but we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance. Likewise, Peter, 1 Peter 1, verse 6 and 7. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So already, what can we establish? That the Christian life is not a trial-free, pain-free zone. James is assuming that pain is par for the course when it comes to the Christian life. We are not promised a pain-free existence. I love how Sinclair Ferguson put it. He said, if Christ himself, the sinless one, had to learn obedience in the school of suffering, who do you think you are that you don't have to suffer? If Christ, as sinless, had to learn obedience in the school of suffering, who do we think we are as sinners to think that we don't need suffering? Well, let's look at verse 3. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And here we come to the important part of how we get to that joy. It's in that key word, know. James appeals to what we know, not what we feel. Today we rush to judge a thing good by the way that it feels, not by what we know. Because think about pain and pleasure in a fallen world. In a fallen world, some of our pleasures are destructive and bad for us. In a fallen world, in the hands of God, our pains can turn out for good. So we have to go by what we know, not by what we feel. We walk by faith, not by sight. We know that the testing of our faith produces steadfastness. This is what we know. Paul says the same thing, knowing that suffering produces endurance. So the joy that we experience lies in two things. Knowing that our suffering is an appointed test by a loving Father, and the potential good of the steadfastness, the endurance that results because of the suffering. So James here is speaking in very terse statements, but there are many things assumed in what he is saying. Firstly, he is assuming that your suffering is not meaningless. It is a test. He calls it the testing of your faith. James, of course, here is assuming the biblical worldview where an all-powerful God who is sovereignly ruling over all things, who allows certain things to take place for our good, with our holiness in mind. The word test and the word temptation is the same word throughout this whole of chapter 1. Why do we see the different English words being used? How do we understand the difference between a test and a temptation? Some distinguish the difference between the outer situation as the test, but the inner temptation towards sin as the temptation. Which means that God can put you in a situation, but the sin comes from where? From him or from you? From your heart. So that's a good way to distinguish it. Another way to distinguish it is to recognize that God, who is sovereign over all, wills our holiness through an event. And so his desire is to test you, to improve you. However, on the other hand, the devil might also want you to be in that situation because it's a hardship, but he hates you and he wants to destroy you. So God and the devil can want the same thing for your life. They can both want you to suffer. But one is a perfect God who cannot sin, who is holy in all that he does, and he wants to make you holy. But the devil wants to destroy you. We all know the example of the book of Job. There was Job. God had a will for his life, the devil had a will for his life, and it both included Job's suffering. But God sought good. The devil sought evil. God was testing. The devil was tempting. So that's another way that many people distinguish these two words. Testing, on the one hand, can reveal something which was false, that only appeared to be true, and it's revealed to be false. So think of the parable of the sower. We know the seed is sown, and one of the seed falls on stony ground. That's the ground that represents, you know, it springs up quickly and the sun comes out, and that represents persecution. And when the persecution comes, that apparent faith proves not to be true faith. It was tested and found wanting. Proved itself not to be genuine, not to be true. But there's another form of testing. This is a form of testing where we refine something, where we expose it to pressure in order to make it stronger. Recently, I had a birthday present given to me where I got to make my own knife. Shane Minier runs a knife-making course in Geraldine. Highly recommend it. and what happens is you arrive there and you get given a piece of steel, a big lump of steel. And what do you have to do? You have to expose it to heat by putting it in the furnace, and then you chuck it under a pneumatic hammer, and you put it back in the furnace, and you put it back under the anvil, and you put it back in the furnace, you put it back in the anvil, as you flatten it out. Then what you do is you take it to the angle grinder and you cut off all the excess parts that you don't need for the shape of your knife. And then you anneal it. You basically put it into a furnace and you slowly allow it to cool. Because unless you take this piece of steel that you flattened out, and unless you go through this process of slow cooling, it won't be hard enough to keep an edge. It'll just keep being soft. And so you have to toughen it through this heating process. And then you'd have to take it to a grinder. And you grind it, all those marks from the forging. And sparks are flying, and you have to wear goggles, and you make sure your fingers don't get near it all, and it's just hours and hours of refining, and you go through different grains of sandpaper to put a polish on it to get it to look good until finally you've got a useful, good-looking tool in your hands. This is the process that God puts us through. And this is the way our pains work in God's hands. Paul in Romans 8 talks about the sufferings of this life, how all creation is groaning. But he also talks about the confidence that we can have in a world where everything has fallen apart in Romans 8:28. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. The one setting the temperature for the furnace is a God who has promised to save us. The one yielding the hammer is the one who has predestined us in love. The one cutting and grinding away the ugly and the useless parts is the one who gave his son for us, and how will he not also with him freely give us all things? The unbeliever cannot have this confidence, but as believers, we can. Let's think a little bit about that word steadfastness. That word in the Greek literally means working under. It's a word picture for bearing a burden, under a heavy burden for a long period of time. Could also be translated as perseverance or endurance. It's interesting that if you wanted to choose, what virtue would be the top benefit of suffering? Now, what's the best of all virtues? It's love, right? But James says, you should rejoice when you go through hard times, not because it produces love, but because it produces what? Steadfastness. Why should we rejoice that we get the opportunity to increase and grow in our endurance, in our perseverance, in our steadfastness? Well, that's because steadfastness is considered a doorway virtue which leads to all the other virtues. Because if you have steadfastness, you will love better, forgive better, give better, suffer better, and all of the other duties that we have. If you have perseverance, you will love when things are tough. You will give when things are tough. You will forgive when things are unjust. You will pursue good even in evil times. Perseverance is what is needed for running a marathon rather than a sprint. Steadfastness is like the muscle that is produced after constant training, where the muscle is broken down to develop even stronger muscles. In order to attain the holiness that God calls us to in a fallen world, this steadfastness is vital. No steadfastness, no holiness. What James is telling us at this point is no pain, no gain. No trials, no steadfastness. Because you can't get the steadfastness, which leads to the holiness, unless you have the trial part. So we count it all joy when we go through trials, because the trials leads to the steadfastness, and the steadfastness leads us to being perfect and lacking nothing. This is the chain of logic that he's mapping out. Therefore, when the trials do come, Christians are a little odd. We view it as an opportunity, not a calamity. We see it as from God's goodness, not from God's justice. This is our opportunity to be refined. And so this is what enables the Christian to lean into the trial. You know when you're doing a workout and you push through the burn? That's what it's like. You're embracing the burn. That's how we interpret the difficulties. Or think about the horrible flavor of a healthy smoothie. You chug it down knowing that it's good for you. Knowing this, we consider it joy. This is not the same as grinning and bearing it. This is not the same as pretending it doesn't hurt. Godliness does not consist in not registering pain. That's a macho thing. That's bad. Men pretend it doesn't hurt. No, by thinking correctly, we can find a true joy, a pure joy, a real joy. And the word joy here, of course, is referring to a type of contentment rather than giggly laughter. We're able to find a true and contented assurance when we consider these things in this manner. We are confident that our Father transforms these trials into something beneficial, not harmful. For this reason, we count it joy. So we attain joy through thinking properly. Let's look at the second point we find in verse 4, the second commandment. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. The first exhortation was to consider it all joy because trials produce steadfastness. Having established that, there's still another thing we must do. Now, you might have heard this saying that trials make you bitter or better. You heard that one? Trials make you bitter or better. Well, here we see how this works. It is because we have to let steadfastness have its full effect. That is the only way in which trials can make us better, not bitter. But if you don't let steadfastness have its full effect, you'll only be resentful for the hard times you go through. It will not produce the joy or the holiness which God intends for you. Think about it this way. What happens if you leave an alloy of mixed metals, you take it to a furnace, you want to separate all the rubbish, the tin and all the dross out of the gold, but you don't let it get hot enough. You don't let it all come to a melting point so that the dross can float to the top. What if you take it out of the fire before it's got to the point of melting? Well, you're not going to extract the dross. What happens if you're going for a long run and you get that burn in your thighs as you start running up the first hill and you decide, oof, this is too hard, I'm going to stop? Will you get fit? No. You won't become fit. Will you learn that mental resilience of pushing through the pain? No, you won't learn that mental resilience because you didn't let steadfastness have its full effect. You pulled out early. What happens when you're on a diet and you feel those first feelings of hunger and you decide to give in? Will you get thinner? No, you didn't let steadfastness have its full effect. That's what James is saying we have to do. What happens if a Christian is being persecuted? And instead of returning good for evil and forgiving 70 times 7 and as far as depends upon you being at peace with all people and praying for those who persecute you, instead they give revenge. They cherish anger and unforgiveness in their hearts. They return evil for evil. That's what it looks like to not let steadfastness have its full effect. You didn't continue on the path of holiness. You gave into sin. You didn't push on. You gave up. If this is the way that we act when we're under duress, we will not become sanctified. We will not learn that steadfastness that we so much need to learn in order to reach that next step, which is perfect, complete, and lacking in nothing. We will not become more like our Savior. So, how do we not let steadfastness have its way? by giving into sin instead of staying holy, by giving into doubts instead of holding fast to faith, by getting angry at God and criticizing him for making our lives hard, or if when we abandon our prayer lives, or we give up our Bible reading, or we stop attending church, or we give in to some form of escapism or some form of indulgence, or we pursue sin in order to try and cheer ourselves up or make our lives easier. When we hide our light under a bushel instead of shining it to avoid persecution. There are any number of ways that we can not let steadfastness have its full effect. Now, let's look at that last part of verse 4. What does James mean by perfect, complete, and lacking in nothing? Perfectionists, those who believe that Christians can be perfect this side of eternity, love this verse because it really sounds like there's no room for anything but perfection. It is true that the word used here can mean absolutely sinless and perfect. But it can also mean mature. It's a 100% legitimate translation, mature. Now, commentators recognize that this word could be speaking of our perfection in heaven or a maturity of holiness. And I guess for us it is a little bit of both, isn't it? Because as believers, what's the goal we're striving for? Do we aim for less than perfection? No, we still strive for perfection. So we don't lower our goal to our ability. We still strive to be holy as he is holy. We do not compromise on the standard. But in this instance, James is not saying that if you suffer well enough, you might just get to be perfect this side of eternity. He's not offering some weird teaching on perfections. He probably means that in the sense of maturity, though we all recognize that we're striving to be holy as he is holy. But then what does he mean then by that word complete? Now this is an interesting word and it will help us as we think about next week. The word complete is a word that you would use to describe an animal brought for sacrifice that had no defect. It's complete. It's perfect. Pure. Flawless. But another meaning of the word, and probably the one that's in the foreground, is something that is unified. In other words, not double-minded, but united. You know, there's that prayer of the psalmist, unite my heart that I may fear you. That's what the word complete means. Whole. United. And so James is saying, mature and single-minded. That's what steadfastness helps you. So as you learn the ability of stickability, endurance, perseverance, steadfastness, steadfastness then enables you to what? Become more mature, more like Christ. And it helps you to be more resolved, more single-minded in your focus as you're able to commit yourself in a more dedicated fashion to the holiness that you're called to. Single-minded, complete. And in this way, you are then lacking in nothing. Now, what does lacking in nothing mean? Does this mean that you'll be rich? Is this a promise? Is this a prosperity gospel verse? No. Lacking in all that you need for attaining holiness, to do the will of God. You have to let steadfastness have its way with you. You have to stick it out so that you grow a character by which you are then more able to obey in every sort of situation. This is what James is encouraging in. We all know that when times are tough, we are tempted to give in, to stop being holy, to stop praying, to question God, to justify sin, and many other things. This group of believers is backslidden, but James is trying to equip them to stay true in tough times. So what does this look like for us? Let me give you a few scenarios. Maybe you are suffering the loss of a loved one. The grief comes in waves. These waves may bring strong temptations to be angry, temptations to blame the incompetence of someone, temptations to unforgiveness, temptations to self-pity, temptations to doubts about God's goodness and the wisdom of his plan. Or maybe the situation that someone is facing is one of loneliness. It's loneliness that's crushing you. And so, because the temptation is loneliness, you may want to compromise on who you can date. Sexual purity, self-control, anger at God, and all of the other sins that may come with that. Or maybe you're suffering from ill health or the ill health of a loved one. And so then you are tempted to covet another's comfort, to doubt and question the wisdom of God's ways and what he has appointed, to grumble and complain, to justify your bad behavior with other people because you are suffering. We all face any number of difficulties. What are the difficulties that you are facing? And how do these verses apply in those difficulties? James is inviting us all to recognize that we are sinners that need trials. They are necessary to help us in order to attain to the holiness that we're called to. The hard times that you would not choose for yourself, we realize that God has, as a loving Father, chosen them in his wisdom for us. These things do not feel good, and they may not even be good in themselves, but in the hands of God are able to produce good. Something that I've been meditating on while thinking about hard times in these verses is, anytime you go through a hard time, as I heard it as a young Christian, what you squeeze, when you get squeezed, what's inside comes out. What was that first reaction you had? What was that first thought? What was that first sin? Was it anger? Was it self-pity? Was it self-righteousness? Was it self-justification? What was that first thing that came out of you? Came out of you as soon as you went through a little bit of a, whether it's just driving and someone cuts you off, or whether it's a very serious thing that happens at work. I don't know. But what was that? Was your knee-jerk reaction Jesus coming out of you, or the devil coming out of you? Who did you look like when you reacted? That knee-jerk, that instinctive reaction. That really helps us to see how necessary the trials are, because we all feel it. We all fall short. We all still have so much sin abiding within us that we need these difficulties to help refine us. All those sins that come so naturally to surface, and they reveal that we're not yet conformed to Christ. So our hearts leap to anger, blame, self-pity, doubt, instead of prayer, trust, meditating on the goodness and the promises of God. So here is how we try and apply and take James' advice. We try and see the good that is happening, the sin that is being exposed, the very things you feel tempted to do are the sins that are being surfaced for you to confess, to mortify, and to replace with the fruits of the Spirit. James is wanting us to see that we have an opportunity that the angels do not have. The angels do not have to serve God through the difficulty of a fallen world. They abide in his presence. They do not have to wrestle with a sinful nature and surrender themselves to God in the midst of trials. You and I have this burden. You and I have this opportunity. You and I are able to serve God in this unique way. And it is by continuing on this path, while thinking about God and his ways and what he is able to accomplish, that we can even transform our grudges into gratitude and even experience a contented joy and not constant complaining. Difficulty is not an excuse to sin. It has become our opportunity to overcome it. Let's pray.